I wanted to build a tool to get all those brands that I already like onto my platform rather than building something to compete with all of them. When I was inside of these large supplement companies, I learned that we have different definitions of innovation. We really value feedback. I think everyone feels safe to give everyone else feedback because I want the feedback. I want to learn. I want to know how I can do better because if I'm doing better, the company will do better. The air quality is pretty poor. And I think, our future ancestors are going, what are you guys doing?
Andrew, it's good to see you again. Last time in our discussion, because I'm a very big supplement fan, I've been taking supplements forever, I realized in our discussion that I could build my own brand of supplements. So I was excited to have this discussion. Why don't you give us a brief introduction about what you're working on?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So, thanks for having me. I'm excited to chat. So I run a company that does private label personalized supplements for businesses that want to sell supplements to their customers. And it's kind of a mouthful, but you know, a lot of the brands that sell supplements right now, they don't manufacture them themselves. They just kind of market them. So we are sort of in that background, in that supply chain. And the thing that makes us unique is that the supplements we sell are all personalized to an end consumer. So it's like we take something very complicated and make it very simple for supplement companies to sort of modernize their offering.
So in a way, if I have my own brand, or if I want to, maybe if I'm a customer of yours and I want to start my own supplement brand, like my problem is I do not want to sort the supply chain. I do not want to manufacture anything. What I have is my the thought that I want to sell supplements, but all the complexity behind the scenes is something that I'm not interested in, which sounds very, very interesting that you are providing this solution. But let's go a bit back. How did things start? What were you doing before starting OK Capture?
Yeah, so I worked in San Francisco. I had an urgent care center, and I'm a naturopathic doctor. So my degree is MD, and I worked with four MDs, medical doctors, in the Mission in San Francisco. We had an urgent care center, and it was great. I was learning like the sort of traditional medical urgent care pharmaceutical approach from them, and they were learning the sort of more integrated and holistic approach from me. And to be fair, we all brought a lot of both to the table, right? Like it was a great group of clinicians to work with. One of the things I saw when I was practicing medicine there was that pharmaceuticals tend to work really well for acute illness. If you break something, if there's something infected, right? If you need something to act quickly, pharmaceutical, and I'm generalizing, but pharmaceuticals tend to be really good for that. Supplements, on the other hand, tend to be effective for more chronic conditions that people sort of have to deal with on an ongoing basis. And I'm generalizing, there's definitely crossover, but that's kind of what I saw when I was practicing. And then I noticed a big sort of like a user experience problem, which is that I could prescribe like one pill for you to, you know, sleep at night, and you just take this one tiny little pill, or I could prescribe three or four or five different supplements that I knew if you took morning and night every day for like 3 weeks, you'd be sleeping better, and then you wouldn't need the pills anymore. But it's a really bad user experience to expect a consumer to open like five bottles two times a day. You know, like it just, the supplements, I learned that they really work if you take them. And, you know, we know consumers, like they have the best intentions, but don't necessarily follow through unless we as the manufacturers or the CPG people make a great experience.
But by having the idea, how do you make it a business? Like, how did you start? Did you look for a co-founder? What was the starting point?
Yeah, the journey is kind of fun. So, being in San Francisco, I, you know, was around all these entrepreneurs. My patients were VCs and founders, and I've always been an entrepreneur. I don't think I ever really like wanted to grow up and be a doctor. I wanted to grow up and just do a million things, and being a doctor was one of them. And so I had a startup before this one where we allowed doctors to sort of search for any diagnosis and see how other doctors would treat it. So sort of crowdsourcing treatments for doctors. And an example is like you know, if you are a doctor and you use a physician's desk reference and you look up a urinary tract infection, how to treat it, it's going to tell you this antibiotic or that antibiotic. But there were no references that were saying, well, what about cranberry or what about D-mannose or what about some of these other sort of less pharmaceutical options that might be available. So I wanted to build that reference and I decided to sort of crowdsource it amongst doctors. So that was called Share Practice. And that was sort of my first venture-backed foray into this world of just building products. So my mind is always sort of like churning on how to solve big problems. And so after I did Share Practice, I'm aging. I wanted to, you know, do everything I can to maintain my health. And for me, supplements is a really big part of that. And I remember there was one day I was looking in my my medicine cabinet at home, which is filled with supplement bottles and then has a little bit of pharmaceuticals. You know, I'm like pulling out the things that I want to take today. And my wife is there doing the same. I'm like, you know, we're doing this every day. And then one day, you know, I've got a little respiratory infection. So I want to get my immune supplements. And we're like, there's got to be a better way to do this. Like, this is ridiculous. You know, it's 2020, it was 2019, I think, at that time. And so it's like, okay, you know, I want a way to make it really easy for me to get the supplements that I want to take into a pack for me. And when I looked around, there was one or two companies that were selling supplements that had sort of an interface for it, but they were very sort of like mass market. The quality wasn't necessarily there. The array of supplements that I would want to take wasn't there. So I just saw like this gap between we have the technology to personalize a convenient experience for me, but the market wasn't quite there. And that's kind of where I saw the white space. And then I didn't want to be a consumer-facing brand because in the supplement industry, there's a lot of brand loyalty associated with like the transparency or the quality of the supplement. So I didn't want to compete with the companies that I thought were doing a good job. I still wanted to take their supplements. I just didn't want them in bottles anymore. So I wanted to build a tool to get all those brands that I already like onto my platform rather than building something to compete with all of them. It's more of a picks and shovels model where like in the background. And that's where the idea came from. It was really trying to solve a personal use case for me.
Chetan, why do you think that most companies today in the supplement space are not offering customized solutions? As in like, indeed, like I have a cabinet myself with probably like 30 supplements and I have to just every day choose the ones I want to take. Like, why are we not there yet?
I'm smiling because I love the answer to this. I've consulted in the supplement space for some of the big companies. And, you know, I came from Silicon Valley and I have an idea of what innovation means to me. But when I was inside of these incumbent, large, old supplement companies, I learned that we have different definitions of innovation. To them, innovation means, and I'm not really exaggerating here, let's look at what our competitors are doing, what new ingredients they've added, and let's add those same new ingredients to our portfolio. That's innovation. And I'm like, this model hasn't changed in 50 years. And now that we have technology that can do what, like that can make a great consumer experience, we have e-commerce is, you know, it's exploded. So it's like the marriage of those two things is what sort of allows for this type of personalized product. But these companies, they're not thinking in terms of like e-commerce and how do we leverage technology, right? And again, I'm generalizing, but that's kind of the theme that I saw when I was inside these companies, which made me think if we build the technology solution for them and sell it to them, then there's a business opportunity there. And I think like you guys are in a similar situation, right? Like you've got these two people that connect their data, but they're not going to do it themselves, right? And so you sit in the middle and do it for them. And I think we're in sort of a very similar place in that like stack, as you could say.
So you had the idea. How did you How did you start from there? Did you say I'm going to raise funding, for example, as the first step? Because I'm guessing it's a very expensive business to run. Or did you say I'm going to bring people? What were your first steps there?
My first step, it may surprise you, but it was really good advice I got from an investor friend of mine. And I was asking him about the idea. He said, why don't you just go get a handful of LOIs from your potential customers and just see if this would be interesting to them? And so I reached out to six companies that spanned just sort of run-of-the-mill supplement company all the way to a DNA test company that wanted to sell personalized supplements based on their DNA results, and a couple of companies in between. And six out of six were like, I would absolutely use that service. So I got six LOIs, letters of intent, and then I went around to some of the previous investors from my last startup, did a friends and family round, and it was pretty easy with those LOIs. It's like, hey, look, there's real businesses that want this solution. And so that's where I started. And then from there, we got sort of a proof of concept going and were able to raise a proper seed round.
Mm. What are the learnings that you took as an entrepreneur in terms of fundraising? Like, what can other founders learn from you there?
This is a really good question, and the answer has probably changed quite a bit over the last few years because the sort of current economic environment for investing has really changed. And you know, Kyriakos, you probably know this too. I would say in times when VCs were sort of flush with capital and like making big bets, like a few years ago, it was probably easier to come with like a great idea, a great team, you know, and a great vision and the ability to execute on it. Now, what I'm seeing in the marketplace now for like advice for founders raising money, a good pitch deck, like if you put a good pitch deck together that has a clear narrative that contains the sort of problem that you're solving, the customers that you're solving it for, the unit economics, you know, I see a lot of founders think that their deck is like a business plan that they had to write in like MBA school. It's just something you have to do, but it's not something you're really going to use. And in my opinion, the more you pitch your deck, the more refined your narrative will get. Because really what you're doing with an investor is you're telling them a story and you're trying to take them along on a ride. Like, we're here and I want you to see this vision that I have, and you have to convey your vision to someone. So your deck, your pitch deck, should be the tool that you use to express your narrative. So I'll, you know, I invest, as I'm sure you do as well. And, you know, I get founders pitching me and I start asking them questions that I feel like I shouldn't have to ask. They should already think it through. And so what that founder should do when I start asking him those questions is say like, oh, these are really good questions. I'm going to write them down and incorporate them into the next revision of my deck. So your pitch deck is kind of constantly being refined until you get it to a point where I'm like, okay, this is good. I've answered all the questions. It checks all the boxes. And now you start pitching. And I what I've seen is too many entrepreneurs sort of the version of the deck that they have is final, and then they go pitch it, they get asked lots of questions, and they don't raise money, and they don't know why, and it's because they're not really refining their narrative over time to check all the important boxes.
You know, that's very interesting, because most advice out there is you need to have these 10 things in your deck. And the reality is your narrative about your product is super important. And then second, like, iterating the questions that people are asking you and the investors that are asking you is so much more important. And then your deck at the end is not going to be those 10 slides. It's going to be the whole story and what people are asking you. And it's more like it's a product that you are improving over time. That's very interesting. Now, I think you mentioned that you did that when it comes to fundraising. You found these six kind of customers at the beginning. Like, would you say that the type of customers you had at the beginning are the type of customers that you have today, or did it change over time?
No, it definitely changed over time. And I wish I could go back and tell young Andrew all the things he should have known then. But at the beginning of our company, we were taking any customer that would sign up with us. I was pitching friends. I was pitching every business. I wasn't asking businesses what their goals and intentions were. I didn't ask if they had a corporate strategy that included a personalized product, right? We were just taking everybody. And over time, we realized there's sort of five categories that make sense for us. There's like digital health companies, you know, probably a lot of your type of customers, companies that want to leverage some sort of data, like maybe it's my Fitbit data, or maybe it's my DNA, and then take action based on those results, right? And supplements is a great example of a DNA test company saying, hey, we've got some research that says based on your DNA, you likely need to take A, B, and Z. Cool. So that's like the digital health category. And then there's like just e-commerce in general. There's companies that may or may not be selling supplements at all. And if they are, they're in bottles and they wanted to sell a pack, right? So not just like a sleep pill, but a whole sleep pack, because they recognize that you kind of have to take three or four things in large quantities to really move the needle. MLM, and we haven't really made any headway there. And there's the healthcare practitioner channel. And that one sort of like fell into our laps. We had an email campaign that was going after a lot of different companies that we thought would sell supplements. And we ended up getting a pretty good clinic that is like kind of our bread and butter customer now. So like we were trying all these different verticals and we realized that what we call the prescriptive influencer has the most control over the end consumer making the decision to purchase. And so what I mean is, if you go to an e-commerce website, you may or may not be convinced that I want to buy a sleep pack or an energy pack or whatever. If your healthcare practitioner is saying, hey, you need to take this adrenal support pack for your because you're tired all morning long, the patient is going to buy that. And we didn't realize this when we started the company. I wasn't thinking this was a healthcare practitioner model, but we've found the most sort of stickiness in that vertical. And so that's, once we learned that, we're like, okay, well, we should get more of those types of companies on our platform, because it seems like a really good model for us.
Yeah. But you know, my impression now is that there is this centralized world when it comes to supplements, whereas you have these big companies create supplements. But the reality is there's like so many of the customers that you mentioned that they could have their own supplement lines. And I'm thinking like even from the podcasts, like even if you see Huberman or Peter Attia and so on, they make so many recommendations, but they could actually have their own brands and sell their own supplements. So like by your success here, basically we're going to be moving into a more decentralized kind of world, whereas everybody can have their own brand in terms of supplements and be very specific. And I was actually doing my, I did a blood analysis lately for my testosterone. I wanted to take my supplements and optimize for that and so on. And I had to buy all these five boxes of different supplements. And I was just thinking before our call that if I just had one packet and I could make my own personal experience of here's how I raised my testosterone, for example, and here's how I did this and here's how I did that, that would be super interesting. So this is kind of a world that is going to change to a much more decentralized mode.
So I have a few things I want to say on that. For the history of this, like supplements, not much has changed. And a brand may or may not be the manufacturer. So there's contract manufacturers like Whole Foods 360 brand, for example, the Whole Foods house brand. They don't make their own pills. They buy those from a contract manufacturer and put their label on it, their brand. So you've got like the raw material, the contract manufacturer that puts the raw material into the pill, into the capsule, and then the brand that is going to sell it. And what we're seeing more and more these days is that the brands are outsourcing the manufacturing to contract manufacturers. And that's not bad. Like there's great contract manufacturers out there. The point is that what is the value of the brand in the supplement space? And the value is the they're sort of handling the supply chain, like transparency for the end consumer. You don't know if the, I don't know, ascorbic acid vitamin C that's in your pill came from a good source. You don't know if it's tested and if it's been validated and verified. So that's kind of the value that the brand provides. And so it's not unimportant. I don't believe that it needs to rest on the brand. So for example, Capsule, we do all of that quality and regulatory stuff, which now, like, I'm going somewhere with this. That makes me wonder, like, okay, if we do that, what is the value that a brand provides that we don't provide? And so this, I think, comes right around to what you're saying for like a Huberman. Like, Andrew Huberman, who's recommending a lot of supplements, if he wanted to be the brand, he could sort of outsource all of the difficult stuff about supplements to us, and the value his brand would provide to his customers would be the specific targeted nutrients that people need for the specific things that he's recommending. And the sort of like the next layer to this is, if you have a company on your platform that's monitoring people's activity, I would guess that they have a sense of if that person's active, sedentary, you know, what sports they do or don't play. And then from there, you can kind of like back into like, okay, we've got a persona here, and I think this persona could benefit from these supplements, and that persona can benefit from those. And then that's the value that the brand provides now, right? The value brands used to provide, I think that's antiquated. I think we're, like you said, we're evolving into something new, and it's really the, how do you get the right pill to the right person at the right time? And that's sort of what we are doing here together.
So if I want to start my own new company today, and I want to recommend, for example, sleep. I have sleep recommendations for people, and I want to create my own brand. Like, what's the process for me to create and source these supplements? And how does this change if I'm using OK Capsule?
It's also a good question. What I would first say is, though, what is your value proposition, right? What's your key differentiator from all the other sleep brands out there? And I would imagine, like, the audience that's listening to this, their key differentiator is some sort of tech, right? They're monitoring something, and they're able to make a recommendation based on that. So if you had your key differentiator and you knew why your sleep thing was is a good idea, what you would normally do is find a contract manufacturer, and you can hire someone to go out and do all this for you. And so that's a process, like just finding a good quality contract manufacturer that you can qualify, which means you need to understand what your qualification criteria is, right? And then you formulate something with them, which takes time and expertise. And then you typically have to purchase what we call an MOQ, a minimum order quantity. And those minimum order quantities tend to be like in the hundreds of thousands of pills. And so you have to put out the cash up front for that. And then you have to wait for that inventory to get produced and made and shipped to your 3PL that you have to have had set up. And now that inventory is going to be sitting there expiring while you're trying to sell it. And that's like the traditional model. That's really how everyone on the internet is selling supplements these days. Mm. Our model is very different. So, because I wanted to be a customer of this model, I said, how can we take on all that risk in inventory and waiting on inventory and formulating stuff and sort of consolidate it and spread it out amongst a lot of clients? So the experience of working with OK Capsule is, say your e-commerce platform is Shopify. You install our Shopify app. You have access to about 60 or 70 high quality products that are available on demand today, ready to go with no minimums, no upfront costs. And you can start selling those products tomorrow on your platform. And because our, in this case, Shopify app allows for personalization, our tech interface would allow this sleep brand to connect whatever the value proposition is that they had, say it was data from an Oura Ring, to an individualized order for that customer. And now every customer can get a unique sleep pack to them. Or they could choose to have a generic sleep pack that is sort of broad. And either of those things are relatively simple to do. So the key differentiators in our model is that there's no cost in inventory for our clients, and there's no like long lead times. We do all the quality, we do all the FDA regulations, like we sort of handle all of that so the business can focus on what they're good at, and we do what we're good at.
Awesome. Like at the beginning of 200s, I had this podcast the other day with Chris Geddin, who basically built his own supplement line, which was Caged Muscle. And I remember back in the day that basically they had the, like, you had supplements, and it was even considered, like, even to a steroid level, that is very, like, people were considering that it's too, you shouldn't be drinking supplements and so on. And then there was all these brands out there that they were selling non-transparent ingredients, and they were saying that it's everything is proprietary and all of that, and very underdose and all that. And then at the era of bodybuilding.com, and when Caged Muscle came to the space, and gym supplements and so on, basically what they came and said, here's the full transparency. Here's where we're sourcing the ingredients from. Here's the exact dosage that you need. And that was like the last evolution, I believe, in this space. What you're doing sounds like the next evolution of this space. I wanted to ask you some of that in terms of sourcing. How important do you think it is? Where are you sourcing the ingredients, the type of quality? How do you monitor for this?
It's not that complicated once you get the hang of it. Mm-hmm. So there's, I think it might surprise people to know that a lot of raw material comes from China, like the actual like raw material. But and that's not bad. Like there are some great suppliers in China that have great pharmaceutical standards. What is more important is the testing on the back end. So we receive all this product from around the world, and then we send it out for testing and make sure that it's, you know, free of contaminants. It's what we ordered. The label says that it is what we, or, you know, like there's a whole lot of just quality checks and balances that because we're doing it, our customers don't have to, right? So they don't need a quality department when we are handling all the quality upstream. So, you know, the answer to your question is like, you want the levers that you have are upstream, find quality suppliers, and then downstream, test them and hold them accountable for, you know, creating what you ordered from them, and that, and you do that with local testing.
Speaking of suppliers, how do you find a good supplier? Especially, for example, if they're in China, did you have to fly there, or how did you make sure that they're choosing the right partner?
Also, a good question. And I did not have to fly to China, so I have a lot of connections in the supplement space. Mm. So I was able to sort of lean on my mentors in that space and have them find the signal within all the noise for me. And that really helped accelerate my learning of this space and also just how fast we were able to move as a company. And so we started in a great spot and then validated that we were in a great spot with our testing. So I would say we were lucky there. And that's the value of having mentors in your space. Is like this is one of those things we could have spent $100,000 in 6 weeks getting nowhere, but I knew the right question to ask to the right guy, and you know, an hour conversation really set me on the right path.
Great. So if we get into the products for a bit, like there is all these new supplements that come into the space, like I don't know, like ashwagandha, and then like you just hear all these new supplements coming all the time. It's like, how are you thinking of that? Like, are you going to be offering everything at the end, or how are you thinking about it?
I'm laughing because these aren't new supplements. Like we've had ashwagandha forever, right?
I think it's like a fashion. It's a
right,
fashion.
Right. It's new in like the zeitgeist, right? More people are hearing about it, which is great. I love that. And so how we're thinking of it is we have a formulary that we put together based on like what our initial customers wanted. And over the sort of 5 years we've been doing this, we've refined it to kind of cover, it's like 80 for 20. We have like 80% of what we actually have 100% of what a lot of people want, but of the 20%, that's not like the 80%, then we've got the 80-20 rule in there. And for those companies, we work with them if they're specialized and nuanced and need something we don't have. We either figure out if we could get it for them or show them how to get it for themselves, and they just kind of supplement what we already make available. on demand. And that model works for some brands and it doesn't for others. And our model can sort of accommodate both.
Mm-hmm. Now, if we maybe transition a bit into, you mentioned, like, I think you inferred a bit something about longevity, but what are you doing about yourself in terms of supplementation?
It's funny. I just before our call, I was getting my pills ready, and I was like, you know what? I should probably save this and show Kyriakos on the call. You know, listening, I don't know. There's probably about 30 pills in this little dish that I have, and it comes from we've got our packets and my pills in this packet, and because I'm weird and I take a lot of pills, I tear open 5 packets instead of opening 30 bottles. Right. What I'm taking is a combination of adrenal support, just kind of looking here, immune support, because it's winter time and everyone I know is sick, and multivitamins and just some things. You know, I have psoriasis. It's like a genetic skin condition. And so I take a massive amount of vitamin D. And there's really good evidence and personal experience to suggest that that's a really effective treatment. So I like using supplements as my first line therapy before I go to pharmaceuticals. And again, I'm not at all opposed to pharmaceuticals. I just, for me personally, I don't want to overuse them when there's sort of less invasive therapies readily available. They just weren't convenient until we started putting them in packets for people.
Mm. That's interesting. Like the question I'm always wondering is for people that, lived for more years, like let's say that they went to hundreds and so on. The main question I have is like, is it because they actually had all the nutrients that were correct? As in like inside in the boundaries? So let's say that their glucose was always in the boundaries, or like their biomarkers was always in the boundaries, or not really?
Okay, also a good question. I think the evidence on longevity around genetics do suggest that if your sibling lives to over 100, you're more likely to have an extended lifespan. But genetics are just sort of like one factor for longevity. But I want to pause for a second and talk about what are we actually talking about when we say longevity. Living to 100 in hospice for the last 10 years is not what people want, right? We want to get to the end as sort of active and vibrant as we can and then go pretty quickly. I'm not expecting to live forever. I'm not very attached to even living very long. I just want the time that I'm here to be optimized because I like feeling good, right? And as a consequence of feeling good, there's a likelihood that I'm extending my lifespan as well, or what we're now calling the health span, right? So the health span is like the number of years you get to enjoy life and then minimize the amount of time that you're just old and not really functioning well. So I don't necessarily think it's a nutrient thing. I think the biggest lever people have is exercise. I think exercise and lean muscle mass are very highly correlated with health span. And so I do those things. But I also know what makes me feel better. And I know that I tend to get sick if I'm traveling and not taking my immune support. And I tend to not get sick when I'm taking my immune support and everyone around me is getting sick. So I've paid attention to the stuff for me personally over the years, and I know how to use these tools. And so I think I use them very effectively. And my sort of personal passion is making it easy for other people to use these tools as effectively as I can.
If we get a bit into specifics there in terms of exercising, why is exercising so important? And then what kind of exercise is it?
There's so many benefits of exercise, from cardiovascular to detoxing through toxins through sweat. I'm not like an exercise physiologist. I'm not an expert in this. I exercise for me personally, but I don't really have any good advice to give my patients about exercise. I think what's most important for people is to pick something that they can do consistently, right? So maybe it's better to run than to walk, but if you hate running and you like walking, you're more likely to walk. So walk. You know, it's going to be trade-offs for everybody. Some people really like sports, some people don't. For me personally, I got into yoga about 10 or 15 years ago in the mission in San Francisco. And that's the thing that stuck for me. So I could have a consistent yoga practice. I could go every day. And for me, it feels really good in my body. I'm not really a sports guy. I don't really like running so much. So I do the things that work for me. And I just encourage people to do the things that you can see yourself doing a decade from now, right? If you tried something, you start and stop, the energy that it takes to start the next thing, and then the next thing after that, like you burn out if you're not motivated to exercise. So that's why I'm just like, just pick the thing that you could do and let's move on. Someone else might have different advice. I'm just telling you sort of what works for me.
So. Yep. What kind of supplements are you excited about today? And then maybe also what kind of technologies in this space are you interested about?
Yeah. So I'd say there's two categories of supplements that I'm excited about. The first being longevity. And because we were just talking about it, there's really good research coming out now supporting various supplements, say like resveratrol and NMN for longevity. And we sort of understand the mechanism of action of how they actually contribute to longevity and keeping the cells young and not aging. So we've got some good evidence on that. And so to me, it's sort of a no-brainer. If I can make it easy for me to adopt this healthy behavior of taking those supplements daily, I'm probably investing in my longevity bank. So I do that. You know, I've got my longevity pack that I take every day. The second category that I'm excited about is immune. I think it's generally accepted now that like vitamin C is a good thing to do if you're sick, right? Like I don't think we really need to convince anybody that vitamin C is helpful. So I think we've had a convergence in the last couple of years of a few things. So one is like in general, people have been opening to the idea of supplements to augment and modify my health over time. But then we also had COVID happen. So we had this pandemic. There was a lot of people asking questions, what do we do here? And the answer came as like, oh, you got to get the shot. And so then a lot of people got a shot. And then it's, well, you got to get another shot. And so I think over the course of that happening, people started asking the question of like, well, is there anything else other than a shot that I could do for myself? Because what's the end game here? Is it a shot a year? I don't want to commit to that. So what else can I do? So during COVID, we saw more new users to the category, the supplement category, than ever before. Like it was a huge growth moment for the supplement industry. And a lot of those users are still here. The growth rate has slowed down, but everybody now knows that vitamin D is something that you should check and take and is associated, higher levels of vitamin D are associated with lower mortality or comorbidity from coronavirus. So I've kind of always intuited and known that, and I've known the science, but now that I have an immune pack and I'm really just taking my immune pack every day in wintertime and flu, cold and flu season, like I'm, you know, generally do really great when I do that. So those are the two that I'm excited about. I think immune support is important for people over time because there are viruses that we live with now, right? They're going around, and I think there's going to be more because we understand viruses better. We have the ability to manufacture them if we want. And I'm not suggesting that they were. I'm just saying like we have that ability. So at some point, it's going to happen. And so I want to just know everything I can do to like just have a robust immune system. And I think other people want that too. So I think it's a good like entry point to the supplement category.
Technologies. There are all these sensors like the CGM devices, for example, that are basically measuring your glucose all the times. And I've seen some lactate ones coming to the market now that they're measuring more dynamically and sweat sensors and so on. And it seems that we are getting into a world that we are going to see more biomarkers, more parameters on a much more dynamic fashion. What's your opinion about these?
I think that the role of the doctor is going to vastly change in the face of all this new technology. A doctor, and I'm going to come to answer your question, but like a doctor is only so good at what they already know and the experience that they've had, but we're very limited in the amount of biomarkers that we could ingest and like make a recommendation on. And the technology that we're getting and the ability to look at so many biomarkers quickly with small amounts of blood or even through sensors in the skin or wearable, I think it's just, it's amazing. And then you take all that and you put it into a model that understands what to make of it. You could spit out a really interesting recommendation that I'm wondering at what point does that recommendation become more interesting than the one that your doctor with his human brain can make. And maybe we're not there today, but we will be there at some point. It could be 5 years away. It could be 30 years away, but it's coming. Like 100%, I'm convinced that computers will be better than doctors at some point soon, if not already. So the next thing then is like, okay, now that I'm a normal consumer, I have access to all this data about myself. What do I do with this? You know, most patients that I had, maybe like 80% of them, again, the 80-20 rule, I'd say like 80% of my patients just wanted me to tell them what to do. They didn't want to think about it. They didn't want to understand what's going on behind the scenes. They just want a recommendation. And then you had the 20% that are interested and curious and like really want to unpack it. I think the opportunity to create tools for that 80% that just want a recommendation that's better than what my doctor can tell me and just easier and more convenient without the waiting room, without all the paperwork and the insurance and all that. Just make a recommendation. The FDA has safeguards in place, so it's difficult to replace a doctor with a health recommendation, right? I can't put on the label, this melatonin will make you sleep, because I'm making like a health claim. And so the FDA is like, you have to go through their process to be able to make a health claim. And there's pros and cons to that. But where I'm going with this is that model is going to have to change as well, because there's going to be too much data. I think that the technology is going to be better than the technology the FDA has. So like, at what point will the FDA become less relevant than the commercially available tools for normal everyday people? And so like, there's a regulatory framework that will be navigated, that will be interesting, but I think technology is going to win hands down. I think it's going to make better recommendations. It might be a bumpy road, but we'll put safeguards in place so that we're not recommending people do dangerous things, you know, but I think that's fairly easy. And I think we could probably do a better job with technology than human brains could do.
And I also think that the things that we know change so much. For example, like I've been looking at my glucose data, for example, and I could see that different foods correlated much different than the classic glycemic index database. Or I've been looking at my workouts, for example, and after a while, when you're doing weightlifting, for example, it's like, it's not really anaerobic because like you get used to it and your heart rate is roughly 125 or 120 BPM. And it's not anaerobic anymore. Whereas like, I remember all the books about the space mentioning that weightlifting, for example, is anaerobic. And it's not always necessarily, especially as, if you're training for many years. So I think that one is the kind of recommendations you can make, that's going to be a bit different, but also the kind of things we know are also going to change a lot.
But that's a trend that's continuing. Like science is always evolving. What we know is always evolving. And I think medicine is no different. Personally, I think at some point in the future, we're going to look back on the use of antibiotics as we now look back on the use of like leeches and mercury, right? Like, yes, they work for some things, but there's all these other costs to taking it. And I think there's going to be more laser focused targeted approaches. So I like asking myself the question, in 100 years, what is someone going to say, man, I can't believe Dr. Brandeis ever thought that was a good idea. You know, and if I run through that in my own little mental model, I sometimes come up with like, maybe this isn't such a good idea. You know, maybe I should like keep looking for a better solution.
But if we get to, okay, capsule again, like what's your big ambition? Where do you see the company being 5 years time for today?
So, yeah, so I've like where I see the company in 5 years, but also where I see the supplement industry in 5 years.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but I've always been really passionate about supplements. I think in my brain, I just see them as like a low-hanging fruit, easy, yes, like why isn't everyone just doing this? And I've been that way at, you know, since I was like 15 years old, I've been taking supplements. I don't know where that comes from, but now that I've sort of validated those early assumptions with science, I sort of want everyone to have access to it. And there's a few reasons. My friends and family, you know, as a doctor, people sort of are always just asking me advice. And I like doing root cause analysis and going as upstream as possible to solve the problem. So, you know, if someone's like, well, what, you know, my joints hurt, I'm going to take an anti-inflammatory. Like, okay. Or is there something we can do to help build up the cartilage in your joints so that they don't hurt anymore? And then you don't need an anti-inflammatory. And people, oh yeah, that makes sense. You know, so like, I want to do that. And the reason for that is not only just better quality of life for people, but also less dependencies on pharmaceuticals. So again, pharmaceuticals are great and they've done amazing things, but it's also a very big industry that has a lot of political power. And I don't believe that pharmaceuticals should be a first line therapy for all the things that they are. I think there's better interventions. So what I would personally like to see is a shift sort of away from pharmaceuticals as first line therapy and towards sort of more sustainable for the organism options. But I think that's going to get disrupted by gene therapy and CRISPR, because those things are going to be able to go more upstream. And it's like, oh, for psoriasis, instead of taking vitamin D, I'll just fix the gene that causes it, and then I don't need to take the vitamin D anymore. So like, I'm really hopeful for that, but that's not commercially available yet. And I'm looking forward to when it is. But in the meantime, we have these amazing solutions that are available to everyone, and they're not that expensive. And so getting people on them sooner means less pharmaceutical intervention later. That's where I kind of see the supplement industry going, and like us helping usher that along by making it convenient for end consumers to take their supplements. As far as the company goes, you know, like every tech entrepreneur, we want to create a big giant company that impacts the world and changes things. And I think we're well on our way, and we want to run this company until it no longer makes sense for my co-founder and I to run it. I don't know what my upper limit is of the size company I can run. I love learning. I've loved the journey here so far. And I'm open to the fact that at some point there might be a better CEO for the company. And whether we exit or we sell it or I move into a chief medical officer position, I don't know. I'm open to all of that. I do think that we're creating a great culture for the people who work here. We practice conscious leadership at OK Capsule. And that's really helped people develop, myself included, just develop as human beings when we go to work, right? So that's very fulfilling. And I really do want to see that culture sort of expand, you know, over the next years that we grow.
Speaking of culture, how would you describe the culture in the company today?
It's a weird mix of a tech company and an understanding of like a tech startup, like understanding build, measure, learn, minimum viable products. Like some of the folks understand that. And then we have sort of on the other end of the spectrum, the sort of quality folks who, like, you know, every single thing needs to be by the book and a process and an SOP, and we have to follow the SOP and we can't deviate from the SOP. And so it's a really, I think, a very healthy clash of like move fast and break things and move slow and follow the SOPs, right? So that's like, I think that's sort of like an underlying foundation. We support, you know, if you're going to fail, do it quickly. Like, you're going to fail. So get it over with as fast as possible and learn from it. Don't make the same mistake multiple times. Make a mistake, it's fine. Learn from it, move on. And I think we really value feedback, right? So I think everyone feels safe to give everyone else feedback because I want the feedback. I want to learn. I want to know how I can do better, because if I'm doing better, the company will do better. And I think really all of that stems from conscious leadership. So it's a sort of a methodology to follow, and it allows people to recognize the responsibility they have in a particular situation and like own it. Like, okay, this is how I screwed up. This is on me. And then I make up over here. This is what I think about you, instead of like blaming someone else. So there's a framework for it, and I think it makes a very healthy work environment for us.
Awesome. Like for the last question, I like your the mental model that you said earlier. So if, I'll use that for a question. If we actually project 100 years into the future, what are the things that you think are we going to be looking back saying, ah, this was totally wrong? Maybe in the medicine space, in the supplement space, in company building?
That's a fun question. So I think, like I said before, the way in which we're using pharmaceuticals today, I think is a bit misguided. I want to see more pharmaceuticals, but I want to see them intervene higher up in the like physiological chain. Right now, a pharmaceutical tries to augment the most downstream symptom, and that tends to have consequences and side effects. So I'd like to see medicine get to a point where it's really like modifying things upstream, where we're decreasing the downstream consequences of the intervention. I think sugar, the way that we look at sugar today is I want to say criminal. You know, like it's illegal to sell, say, opiates and purposefully try to get people addicted to your drug that is bad for you. Like that's illegal. That's bad. But isn't that the same exact business model for Coca-Cola? Sell an addictive drug, get people hooked on it and profit from it. And I think at some point we're going to wake up and realize that, okay, sugar is really, really bad. Like it was never fat in the 90s when we thought fat was bad. No, it was sugar. And I think at some point we're going to realize like we're giving kids sugar. We're getting so many people hooked on this drug. It's a drug. And so that alone, I think, is going to remove a lot of the obesity related illnesses that we have, like the main illnesses of people I think are caused by sugar. And then, of course, insurance companies, and we all end up paying for it. So if we took sugar out of the equation, I think that would be a huge like leap forward. And I think our future ancestors are probably just like shaking their heads saying, what are they doing? I think clean air and clean water are also going to be things like, you know, I was in Mexico City the other day, and there's just this like haze above the city. And I'm like, oh, you know, my throat's kind of irritating. Like, oh, yeah, you get used to that. Like, that can't be good. You know, like, we don't see it, so we don't think it's a problem. And you don't see the air you breathe, unless you smell something weird. You know, you don't really know what's in the air. And it seems like in these major metropolitan areas, the air quality is pretty poor. And I think, our future ancestors are going, what are you guys doing? Like, you can't breathe that stuff in. It's really, really bad for you. And over time, then you get cancer. And you're like, why do I have cancer? You know, you have this poor lifestyle. So I think just that sort of shift in mindset of, like, what can I do now to prevent the bad thing later? You know, because it's a lot easier to prevent something than it is to treat it.
Super. Andrew, it's been a super insightful conversation. Thank you so much.
Cool. Yeah, I'm glad we were able to connect.